National news from a grassroots perspective. You're listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast. Today on Groundwire.
Yeah, safe space is vital. It's the difference for some people between dropping out and not dropping out.
There's a movement right now coming from the media, from the politics, the government, and the police, of course, that is trying to destroy dissidents.
Hello, and welcome to Groundwire. My name is Camille Baker.
And I'm Haley McKinnon.
And we'll be your hosts for today. Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
This week, Groundwire was produced on traditional Mohawk territory at CKUT in Montreal. Coming up, a popular commission on political repression in Quebec, tuition hikes for international students at Simon Fraser University in BC, and sex workers protest new laws outlawing prostitution.
That's all coming up on this edition of Groundwire. But first, here are the headlines.
In British Columbia, a province-wide teacher strike canceled what would be the third week of classes. Around 40,000 teachers have been out on the picket lines since the end of last school year, demanding more control over class sizes, better wages, and more government funding for education. On September 14th, thousands of people came out to a rally in downtown Vancouver to show their support for striking teachers. As of Groundwire production time, no deal has been reached between the BC Teachers Federation and the provincial government.
In Indigenous news, four delegates of the Aboriginal Provisional Government of Australia have been on a cross-Canada tour for the last few weeks to participate in nation-to-nation talks with First Nations groups of Turtle Island. The tour has prioritized developing relationships with First Nations on the front line of land defense, such as the Unistoten camp in unceded British Columbia and the Mi'kmaq Warrior Society in New Brunswick. The group also hopes to learn from the Native experience with treaties like the Nisga Final Agreement signed in 2000. The delegates traveled in and out of Canada on Aboriginal passports rather than Australian ones as an assertion of sovereignty from the Australian state.
A rally and teach-in about safe space took place during Frosh Week at Carleton University in response to Frosh leaders wearing t-shirts threatening safe space. Ophira Horowitz brings us this headline from Ottawa.
Frosh leaders at Carleton University were under criticism earlier this week after photos circulated on social media showing the Orientation Week leaders wearing t-shirts that said "Fuck safe space" across the front. Some Frosh leaders defended the shirts, saying that they were protesting the university's policy that they aren't allowed to swear when conducting orientation on the grounds that this is a violation of free speech. An apology published by the Frosh leaders on the Carleton University website called the t-shirts misguided and said that they would take responsibility by doing hours of community service. The apology followed on the heels of a small rally called Embrace Safe Space, organized by about a dozen students to engage people to talk about safe space and to address the issues that led to the stunt in the first place. Julia Allen helped organize the rally.
At first, I was really pissed, and then I was like, you know what? This actually offers us a really unique opportunity to take this and turn it into something positive. It doesn't have to be outrageous. It doesn't have to be angry. This just like opens up a conversation that we need to have. We very obviously need to have about safe space, because if Carleton students are wearing those shirts and they're not understanding what it means, even though it says that we have to do that in our rules of student conduct, there's a miscommunication. There's like a disconnect. Something that I sort of decided on Monday after the rally, I was like, after I left the rally and I had to go to class or whatever, I was like, this doesn't really need to end here. It doesn't need to be one day. You know what I'm saying? Like, this isn't just a thing that's going to go away. I think we need to continue to talk to people and engage in productive conversations and educate them, if they're willing. Like I said, because ignorance is something that you can work with.
Marissa Taylor Meisner trained all of the Frosh facilitators in safe space conduct. She works at the Gender and Sexuality Resource Center at Carleton. Marissa spoke about the importance of safe space on campus.
Yeah, safe space is vital. It's the difference for some people between dropping out and not dropping out. And a lot of things similar to that. Because if people literally do not feel safe in their bodies as a result of sexual violence or as a result of transphobia, transmisogyny, or even things like fatphobia, like, people are made to feel really unsafe in their body. So by making places like the GSRC, we make sure that queer people have a space to meet other people like them, to chat about relevant issues, and to get support.
This is Ophira Horwitz reporting from Ottawa for Groundwire.
And finally, in migrant justice news, a woman and her three children were deported to their home country of Nigeria from Montreal on September 14th. Winifred Agimelin said she feared for her and her children's safety in Nigeria, which she fled after she and her two oldest children were kidnapped and threatened with death. The family supporters held a rally at Montreal's Trudeau Airport on the day the deportation was supposed to happen, but the Canadian government went ahead with the deportation as planned. According to Solidarity Across Borders, an average of 14,000 refugee claimants are deported from Canada every year.
That's all for headlines. You can visit us online at groundwire.ncra.ca. And now for our feature stories. Canada's laws criminalizing sex work were struck down in a Supreme Court decision last December, and the Harper government was given 1 year to write new ones. In response, they have tabled Bill C-36. Largely based on the Nordic model, Bill C-36 proposes to criminalize clients rather than sex workers. Sex worker activists and their allies were in Ottawa the week of September 8th to testify at the Senate hearing on Bill C-36. CKUT's Leila Lemgalef brings us this report.
One of the salient debates at the heart of Bill C-36 is that while the bill is known as the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act, it would also make prostitution between adults illegal for the first time in Canada. Valerie Scott is legal coordinator for the network Sex Professionals of Canada. Speaking to Senate last week, she pointed out that there are already laws on the books to go after the sex industry's violent criminals. Here's what she said after her stance in Senate.
I think an important thing for your listeners to know is that what is human trafficking? Most people think of that as someone forcing a person, moving them from location to location, forcing them into sexual servitude. But the prohibitionists, the religious groups who intervened in our case, and some feminist groups, not very many, but the ones that did intervene in our case against us, they have changed the definition of human trafficking, although they didn't bother to tell the press this, or they don't tell the public this either. It isn't moving a person or forcing a person. What it is, and they consider anyone in sex work to be humanly trafficked. They consider me to be humanly trafficked, even though I have complete control over my who I see, when I see them, what I do. I don't share my money with anyone, but I'm considered to be humanly trafficked because they say that the damage that sex work has done to me has damaged my mind, and I'm suffering from what they call a false consciousness, and therefore I can't understand. In other words, we're so stupid that we can't understand how awful sex work is for us. Basically what they're saying is that adult women are simply not equipped to mentally equipped to make the decision to have paid sex.
Naomi Sayers is founder of Southwestern Ontario Sex Workers, and she is currently a common law student at the University of Ottawa.
Sex workers are Christians too. Sex workers are capable of making their own decisions about their own lives, and that we should give them the ability to make their own decisions about their own lives. And when we talk in the discussion about sex work, and sex work is exploitative, sex work is abuse, sex work is violence, and that sex work is not empowering, we don't focus on the fact that it is because of these laws that create those conditions. And when we criminalize something, we also add stigma to that act. So when we say that prostitutions are being victims, I'm not saying that there aren't victims and that we should ignore their experiences, but I'm saying that we really need to diversify the discussion here, because sex workers, as just like the general population, is that, you know, they come from diverse backgrounds, diverse experiences. And, you know, sometimes, like just yesterday, I was speaking with another colleague of mine who is a sex worker. She says, you know, I wish I could talk about my experiences in the sex trade, but I have to be careful because those can be used against us. And, like, we're talking about the violence that we experience, and, you know, even if it's not in the context of sex work, we have that violence being used against us and saying, you know what, because you're a sex worker, that is happening to you. Well, no, it's because of the criminalization and stigmatization that comes from the criminalization, which then contributes to this, you know, this uncaring people. Not that they don't care, it's just they just don't know. And we have to, you know, use this as an opportunity to educate, and people have to be willing to learn. And we're not asking people to change their beliefs, their values about their own selves. We're just asking people to be open to the idea that, you know what, sometimes people do this and sometimes people need help and protection. And when we criminalize the lives of sex workers, we can't give them protection that they may need.
For CKUT News in Montreal, I'm Leila Lemgalef.
The Popular Commission on Political Repression is underway across Quebec, looking at political repression in the province going back to 1990. Spurred by the spike in police violence during the Quebec student strike of 2012, the commission hopes to shed light on repression and to hold government and police agencies accountable. CKUT's Tiffany Lamb brings us this report from Montreal.
On Friday, September 12th and Saturday, September 13th, the first of six meetings throughout Quebec convened at Concordia University. The first day of Montreal's Popular Commission on Political Repression saw testimonials from organizations and individuals alike.
My name is Brice Dansereau-Olivier, and I am a spokesperson for the CPRP.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the CPRP?
Well, it's a citizens' initiative to document political repression in Quebec between the 1990s and today. We're having traveling hearings all over Quebec, so this is the first wave that are being held on the September 12th and 13th at Concordia University in Montreal. We'll be going to Quebec City, we'll be going to Gatineau, we'll be going to Sherbrooke, we'll be going to Sept-Îles, and we'll be going to Ouachette, which is an Innu community. In the north, we're also in talks with some other regions to have hearings locally, and things have been going well. It's actually so popular that we're already setting up a second wave of audiences in Montreal for late October.
What are some of the experiences that you want to capture with this commission, or hopefully capture?
Well, we don't have an agenda as to what we want to capture. What's interesting is that it's people that came forward with their testimonies, so we'll see what comes out of the testimonies, you know. Obviously, a lot of people seem to think political repression in Quebec is only the 2012 student strike, but most of the people that came forward to testify, not most, but I'd say easily half of them have nothing to do with the student strike. And that's really something that's interesting, and we're going to be able to, you know, capture a wide range of experiences.
And after these testimonies, you guys are hoping to write a report, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So the commissioners that we have, we'll be analyzing all the testimonies that they receive. Mm-hmm. So what they're going to be documenting, we don't know what the result will be, but they'll be documenting how political repression is articulated, what are its consequences, and how we can prevent and or fight political repression.
Mm-hmm. And who are you guys submitting this to exactly?
We're actually not submitting it to anybody in particular. It will be published. It will be widely distributed. It's meant to be used by people studying political repression. It's meant to be used by people that are being victims of political repression. It's meant to be used by journalists, by academics. It's really something we want to produce, a document that's unique, that's never been done before in Quebec, where we study exactly this political repression over a wide period of time, so the 90s until today. Mm-hmm. And really, it's going to be a unique document that's going to be some sort of stepping stone to building more reflection on political repression.
Commissioner Will Prosper also spoke to Groundwire about the importance of the commission and what he thought about Friday's witnesses.
I think it's important for me to be here to be present at this commission because I think there's a movement right now coming from the media, from the politics, the government, and the police, of course, that is trying to destroy the dissidents, any movement that is in non-agreement with what's going on, which could be against political views or environmental or feminist or any group like that. I feel that right now anti-capitalistic groups are as well. I feel like they're trying to shut down those different movements and to kill the dissident voice in our society. So that's why I think it's very important to see what are the means that these different groups are using to kill the dissidents. We can see that it's not a case that was isolated. It's different groups from different origins that have been victim of the same kind of system. So I think that was very interesting. And from all the information, sometimes, you know, I know lots of cases because I've took part of marches. I've been arrested as well at the G20 summit, and I've known some stories in the past. But sometimes they mention something that you did not see, that you were not thinking of. So I think it was very enriching. I won't say that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's good. Okay.
Recording nor live tweeting was allowed at the commission on Friday. Environmental groups, including Greenpeace Quebec, spoke of slap lawsuits being used to drain their monetary resources, how the criminalization of environmental activism justified police surveillance on members' movements, and how fear of being sued and being labeled eco-terrorists all discouraged groups. Individuals who came forward, as well as the Christian Labor Association of Canada, reported excessive use of force by the police, as well as prolonged interrogations.
In our next feature, Megan Thomas brings us an in-depth discussion of Simon Fraser University's recent international student tuition hikes. The increased medical insurance fees also include a kickback to the university.
According to SFU's 2013-2014 operating budget and financial plan, international students are looking at a 10% per year increase in tuition over the next 3 years. There is no limit to tuition increases for international students, compared to 2% for domestic students, and international students already pay an average of 2 to 3 times the tuition of domestic students. Moreover, this increase will be compounding, meaning that the overall increase will be more than 30% higher compared to current rates. On August 29th, the Simon Fraser Student Society held a town hall with the Teaching Support Staff Union and international student groups to discuss what the TSSU is calling the gouging of international students at SFU through exploitative tuition increases and medical coverage expenses. The latter issue, medical coverage through the Guard.me program, is not just an issue of costs, but of kickbacks being received by SFU as an incentive included in the medical plan, which was the most expensive of all proposals received. I spoke to Regan Bellin, chief steward and spokesperson of the TSSU, about the issues behind the Guard.me medical plan and how it equates to what she calls a backdoor tuition increase on top of the increase facing them in the next 3 years.
Sort of the backstory of it is that when you arrive in Canada or in BC from another country, you aren't covered by BC MSP right away. You have up to three month gap, and many universities have instituted a mandatory insurance plan to cover that time period so that if you need to go to the hospital or you need to go to the emergency room, you are going to be covered. You're not going to be also hit with a giant bill later. And so we think that the spirit of this is very good, but what we found upon looking is that SFU's plan was twice as expensive as comparable plans at UVic and UBC, and it was also incredibly difficult for anyone to get out of. It automatically re-enrolls people semester after semester, even though you only need it for the first 2 to 3 months that you're here, and the metrics of proof were quite difficult. On top of that, we also have collective agreement language for our members that during that time they can choose to have private insurance, but they don't have to. It says a member may elect to select private insurance, and they're guaranteed a 50% reimbursement of that insurance, but the reimbursement rate is out of date, and so instead of getting 50% of this $353 charge, they're only getting about $40 back. So it ends up being about 12% of the premium rather than the 50% that's guaranteed in our collective agreement.
And there was actually a benefit to SFU from choosing this plan. Can you elaborate on what
that benefit is?
Sure. Well, so because we have collective agreement language that addresses international students purchasing insurance, we were wondering why we weren't consulted at the implementation of this mandatory medical plan. So through the Freedom of Information and Privacy Act, we received the request for proposal from SFU and the five contract bids from the companies that submitted to be this insurance plan. And so what we found was that not only was GuardMe the most expensive plan that was bid, but GuardMe also proposed four different plans, and the plan that was chosen was the most expensive. And the only difference between the proposals that we saw is that in the category, what can you do for SFU, GuardMe said 5% of the premiums back to SFU with no conditions. What that is translated to, in our opinion, is really a backdoor tuition hike on international students. If you look at the numbers of an undergraduate class, international students are 20% of the undergraduate population, and they bear an equal tuition input from domestic students. So it's really unfair to talk about fiscal austerity and then expect international students to pick up that burden.
Two speakers at the town hall, Hassan Liaquat at the Pakistan Student Association and president of the African Students Association, Munatsi Wavina, stopped by CJSF to tell their stories and reiterate their comments and concerns from the August 29th town hall meeting.
Hi, I'm Munatsi Mavima, and I'm the president of the African Students Association, as well as a third-year political science student. I'm from Zimbabwe, and it's a country with a very kind of infamous dictator, so there's not a lot of opportunities after high school, almost a necessity to sort of get out of high school and like leave the country in order to, you know, make a better life for yourself.
My name's Hassan Liaquat. I'm basically from Pakistan, and I started my career off over here. Came to FIC, Fraser International College. I stayed there for 1.5 years, and during this time I got an opportunity to participate in elections for Pakistan Student Association. That's the group I'm associated with. I've been with them for 2 years now.
So what are some of the assumptions that people have about international students?
That we're all pretty well off, which sometimes or not. I've had the privilege of meeting people from, you know, very privileged backgrounds and sort of refugee situations. So, you know, I've heard stories of people coming from refugee camps in Rwanda and the like to SFU on different sorts of scholarship and support, and basically just, you know, studying and trying to make the best of it.
How would you characterize the relationship between SFU, the institution, and international students based on your own experience?
Well, if I can be candid, I would have to say it's sort of a very workman-like relationship. It's very, you give us money and we let you go here.
Do you see that as a contrast to domestic students?
I would say a difference of degree. I know a few local students that have complained about the university being very, you know, impersonal about things, and the main thing with that is they just have more avenues to, you know, complain or to advocate for changes, and international students really don't. The main thing that I said at the town hall and that I'd like to say now is we're advocating for change and we'd like some sort of change to happen, but the main thing is just, one, to be heard, and two, for the university to sort of take accountability for what they did, sort of say we did this and this is how we did it, because a lot of people just don't know this is happening. And I think that's the most, I don't want to say heinous, but it's the worst thing about it, is people just don't know that all this is happening to them, and it's something that affects students very, very drastically.
The only very few international students who actually know about this, like with the helpline, they don't know. They might be thinking they're paying the same as others, but the awareness is not out there.
And now for GroundWire's Community Radio Report.
The World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, or AMARC, welcomed the Independent High Authority for Audiovisual Communication, or HICA's, decision to give 8 new licenses for the establishment and operation of associative radio channels in Tunisia, lifting that country's number of community radios with an FM license to 10. CKUT's Anna Marchese interviewed Francesco Diazio, the Secretary General of AMARC, to discuss these new licenses. Tunisia is the only North African country with a radio landscape open to civil society. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, after the so-called Arabic Spring, the Tunisia government went through a very serious reform approach. So there is a new assembly which was elected with the aim to rewrite the constitution. And among the different things that have happened on the political level, Tunisia has witnessed for the first time in North Africa the creation of an independent regulatory authority. AMARC has established since the beginning a very, very strong and open dialogue. Through our experts and through our members, we succeed to put in place a platform where we could discuss and amend and propose the political steps to undertake in order to guarantee a fully pluralistic landscape in Tunisia. And thanks to the support of many other international NGOs, like Reporters Sans Frontières, but also thanks to the European Union, who granted some important projects in order to put in place independent radio stations in the country. So through a wide alliance of different stakeholders, at the end, we succeed to establish a roadmap, and at the end of the roadmap, the AICA has now granted some new license for the community radio stations and the community radio movement. This is very important on two different levels. The first one is that the authority and the government recognize the audiovisual landscape is no longer in the hands of the monopoly of the public service or commercial services. So there is the fully acknowledgement of the community media sector, which is something important because even in Europe we don't have this fully acknowledgement, especially in some countries in Central and Eastern Europe. And the second one, after the acknowledgement, is to grant licenses and to grant the possibility to be on air. There is a third aspect which is very important. Until now in Tunisia, all the broadcasters had to rent a kind of service provided by a state company which is called ONT, Office National de Télécommunication. Just to give you an idea, for an independent broadcaster, in order to have access to a transmitter and cover the capital, so Tunis, they had to spend something like 60,000 to 70,000Canadian dollars per year, while a single transmitter costs no more than 5,000. So you can see the huge difference between the amount of money that was asked before and the truly cost of independent broadcasters. So thanks now to the efforts that we made in this last year, the monopoly of ONT is also finished. And so now broadcasters are free to have their own transmitters and their own antenna systems. At the end, the granting of license means full acknowledgement of the community radio sector, have on air many radio stations with a national union gathering them together, and thirdly, the end of the monopoly of this Office National de Télécommunication. So these are the big achievements that are behind the granting of new license, and this is why we consider that this is an historical step, not only for Tunisia, but for all the countries that participated in the Arabic Springs and which are now in very complicated situations, and I think especially to Libya, Egypt, and the other neighboring countries.
That's all for this edition of Groundwire. From CKUT in Montreal, thanks for tuning in. I'm Camille Baker.
And I'm Haley McKinnon. We thank Tiffany Lamb, Anna Marchese, Carly Forbes, Gretchen King, Aaron Lakoff, Ophira Horitz, Layla Lemgalef, and Megan Thomas.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download this and past episodes at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.